you have never worked on a farm or you don't understand the day to day, we like to call it the boots on the ground, you know, like what actually happens when the vet is not there looking over their shoulder, is I can have all of the best protocols in the world. And on paper, it can be, you know, exactly right. And there are no results if that doesn't get implemented. So translating that both in a way that the labor on the farm understands, but it also has to be something that they are able to do, or really doesn't matter at the end of the day for you to get the end results that everybody wants. It has to be able to be implemented. And so, you know, the labor is the key final step of, you know, any great plan. It still has to actually be pulled off.
The Swinet Podcast Show Canada is only possible with the support and trust of innovative companies like
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. When it comes to 25-hydroxy D3 products, purity matters. Hi-D is a pure, effective 25-hydroxy D3 solution to help pigs improve their vitamin D status. Learn more at hy-d.info. Top Pigs Norsvin, the world's most innovative swine genetics company.
Well, good morning. This is another interesting conversation that I like to have for Swine Eat Canada. With me, I have today Dr. Daniel Gachot, who is located in Indiana and is part of the Four-Star Veterinary Service. Welcome today.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So today, I would like to have a conversation with you talking about how does decision-making impact profitability, particularly in the farrowing part of swine production. So to start off that conversation, what might be some of the main drivers of managing towards a profitable swine herd or sow herd from your perspective?
I think the first thing to keep in mind is what is the goal or the target of the operation. And that might sound simple, you know, everybody wants to make money, but that doesn't necessarily specify, you know, it really depends. Are you selling wean pigs? Are you, fair to finish, keeping everything in house? And some of those protocols and decisions you might make might not always be the same, depending on, you know, which situation. So there are things that you can do in farrowing that will not change, you know, maybe the weight or the number of pigs you put out the door, but they might do better in the nursery. And that's a, you know, if you sell your pigs on the open market, everybody would like their pigs to do well post weaning, but to eat some of that expense that you won't get a return on yourself, you know, you may want to have that discussion with the buyer. And so really, you know, that's not a very detailed answer as to actual protocols, but it just comes down to your business and your model, what things you do to make money for you, which may not be the same across all situations.
Just as a follow-up, so the answer would then also depend on what kind of system the nursery pigs are ending up in from a health perspective, perhaps.
Absolutely. Like even if you say are retaining ownership of the pigs yourself, if you are a batch farm and, you know, you wean clean groups of larger numbers that go to maybe an all-in, all-out nursery that's high health, there are steps that we would take differently if, you know, maybe unfortunately they're forced to go into a continuous flow site that might have PRRS. Well, there are things that would be a good thing to do that would be a positive ROI in that PRRS scenario that would arguably be, in some scenarios, a waste of money for you to even do those things on your, you know, health farm. So again, yeah, everything from who's buying them to the location they're going to the health status of where they're going. A lot of those things need to be factored in before you can, you know, kind of determine what would make the most sense for your operation.
WiseNetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access WiseNetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
So when you would look at your clients, how many would fall in the category that they keep their own nursery pigs versus how many would sell their nursery pigs so that they're raised somewhere else?
My area of the country is a little bit unique. in the U.S., you tend to think of the really big, dense areas as being, you know, Minnesota and Iowa and those areas. But the northern half of Illinois, Indiana, Ohio is a very big, dense area. And so, unfortunately, the disease pressure in that area leads to probably a lower representation of sow farms that sell weaned pigs, because that's your business model. You would prefer to not have a sow farm in these locations. So we do have a decent number of sow farms, but most of those are retaining ownership. I mean, they would be fair to finish. And we have contract finishing. The sort of split model of the sow farms that sell weaned pigs and the finishing, we're on the finishing end. So, you know, the sow farms that their model is to sell the weaned pigs are generally not in my immediate area. So most of my sow farm clients are retaining ownership. The pigs that are finished by businesses that bought them as weaned pigs, those pigs come from, you know, Southeast United States or West.
Iowa, sorry, Nebraska, South Dakota. Okay, clear. Thanks. So when you then look at making those decisions, what is then actually the role of people in the barn relative to some of those production outcomes that you would be aiming for, either when you sell the pigs or when you keep the pigs?
Well, there's kind of two parts to that discussion, and I think everybody understands how important labor is. And especially in recent years, I mean, a labor shortage, or I should say a shortage of qualified and willing labor, is a critical limiting factor to a lot of farms, you know, even more so than, say, a health challenge, because you have a lot of independently owned, historically owned by a family that maybe they don't have children that want to get into the swine business. And people who are willing and experienced to, say, manage a swine farm are few and far between. So there's the immediate, just simply lack of labor. But then there's also the part that I think is especially critical as a veterinarian to recognize is if you have never worked on a farm or you don't understand the day-to-day, we like to call it the boots on the ground, you know, like what actually happens when the vet is not there looking over their shoulder, is I can have all of the best protocols in the world. And on paper, it can be, you know, exactly right. And there are no results if that doesn't get implemented. So translating that both in a way that the labor on the farm understands, but it also has to be something that they are able to do, or really doesn't matter at the end of the day for you to get the end results that everybody wants. It has to be able to be implemented. And so, you know, the labor is the key final step of, you know, any great plan. It still has to actually be pulled off.
So what have you then seen in your career with how owners have managed this issue? Obviously, part of it is you hire people from the outside the farm to do labor on the farm. But what then about the training perspective? What have you seen that owners have been doing there to help with this gap?
I think something that owners or managers in general have had to maybe adjust their understanding over the last few years is it's hard, at least in my area, to compete on just a straight wage. Versus if a person does not have an interest in working on a farm, you know, they can go to a factory and make good money. And so it's hard for the number alone, like the paycheck, to be the only reason to attract qualified labor. And so there has to be other variables, you know. And one simple thing is, even if it's just a strategic, and maybe it's not even really a benefit, but I think it's an advantage, is let the labor be more actively involved in some of the decision making. And, you know, obviously they don't control maybe the giant financial decisions, but you're to get someone to want to work on a farm, they need to feel like it's their farm, you know, and have personal involvement. Because if they are just minimum wage hired labor, it's hard to get the labor that you want, because those people that have the ambition and the, you know, take ownership, they can get paid more somewhere else. So we have to find those ways to give, you know, extra, maybe not even financial incentives, but additional, you know, benefits to convince people that they want to be part of the whole picture.
Interesting. Is it then also a role perhaps of veterinarians to help with creating some decision models or flow charts with, if this happens to your pigs, these are the two options that you have?
I think it's always important to help, like going back to what you were asking about, you know, labor decisions, changes actually being implemented. It's one thing to give a set of directions to someone and say, do it. And then a lot of people are good at following directions and they will do it. But if you really want results, and it might sound simple, but take the time to explain why they are doing those things and what will be the, you know, the benefit, the outcome, the positive thing that will happen if they do it. And it's not a matter of just following directions, you know, it's the understanding of why that then people really care more. And you can never put every single instruction word for word on a piece of paper. And so the most critical thing for me is that they understand why and they understand the end goal, so that they actually can, you know, think objectively about the situation, because I won't have an SOP for, you know, every single thing they might encounter in say a farrowing room. And so when people understand why what they're doing, then the positive outcome is more rewarding, you know, because it's like they caused that positive thing.
Yeah, so that's then part of linking back to personal motivation. Are some of the producers that you work with perhaps also have some kind of an incentive-based part of the salary component to?
Yeah, that is used on some farms. It can go both ways. Some farms it works very well. Some farms it can inadvertently go the other way, you know, because, for example, my favorite, which this only works if it's a farrow to finish operation, is everybody gets maybe a bonus or compensation based on the performance of the whole operation, you know, and not have it pieced apart, because you can inadvertently lead to scenarios where, say, farrowing labor is rewarded just on pure number of pigs out the door. And then that can lead to maybe decisions that aren't a net gain for the whole operation, you know, for sending, you know, poor quality pigs, it leads to worse performance. Then the nursery management may be penalized for, you know, mortality just because he got pigs that he shouldn't have even got, you know. And so it really works. Those scenarios can work to have incentives, but it works the best when everyone is all on the same team. You don't want to lead to, like, between different parts of your operation battling each other to try and get that incentive.
I would agree with that. Yep. Now, as a veterinarian, how much influence or how would you work with nutritionists to think about the diet nutrient profile during gestation or into lactation in managing the sows?
I think nutrition is one of those things that is obviously very important, but can be overlooked because we just always assume it's happening right. And to be fair, I mean, I think in modern times, most of our regular commercially available, you know, the nutrition companies that I work with, part of it is because I certainly don't claim to be a nutritionist and maybe I'm overly trusting, but I just really don't run into scenarios where, you know, nutrition is, you know, completely, like, errors can be made, but commercially available swine diets are not just inherently wrong in modern times. Now, once in a while, we'll run into things where, you know, it was a mixing error, for example. But as far as, you know, the nutrient profile, I don't think about it as much as I used to, not because it's any less important, but because I've gained confidence that it's right. So it's more the exception when it's wrong than, you know, top of my list. Now, it doesn't mean it's any less important. It's just, it's usually right. And so with these modern genetics that we deal with, these very high producing animals, you know, extremely high total borns and born alives, when it comes to nutrition, probably my bigger focus is more on the farm, the management of the farm, the husbandry, and getting the sows to eat the feed rather than, you know, the composition. I would say if it's nutrient related issues, thankfully, and this is a good thing, 9 times out of 10, it's more of a feed intake concern than, you know, they're intaking what they should and the feed is not to its potential.
Well, let's follow up on that. So, but because I agree with that, how would you then recommend producers deal with feed allowance, particularly in the first week of lactation? Because there's always a bit of discussion around, should we give free access to feed or should we carefully titrate an increase in feed allowance until they maximize the feed intake? Like, what have you seen?
This is like one of those questions where I hesitate to give a this is the right way, because I think the closest to best, if you were going to give a universal recommendation, is to start with, we want to maximize feed intake through the lactation period, just net maximize. But as I'm sure you're somewhat alluding to, there are some opinions that, you know, right after farrowing, you give that sow all she can eat. Most of the time that can actually work fine, but you'll have a few that will tank up on feed, overeat for lack of a better term, maybe right away. And then it may not even be like a true constipation mechanism, but she's just simply full and she lays down and really doesn't eat much for the next 2-3 days. And then that, and if you track that from start to finish, that can sometimes lead to net less total feed intake throughout the farrowing. And so I can say I do like a slight titration. I mean, I'm of the opinion that it can ramp up pretty fast because most of us can get on feed. And so if you're an operation that can track the details like that, you know, whether it's X amount of feed day one, and then if she eats that, you bump it to this, and she said, like, that is proper. The reason I hesitate to say every farm should do that is because it requires the labor or the person that can do that right and keep track of that. And if I tell them, don't ramp up too fast, and then I check back in and I realize there are sows that have been farrowed for a week and they're at 6 pounds.
Yeah.
And like, okay, in that scenario, maybe you would have been better off just going full feed. There is a best scenario, but fitting it to your farm, what you can pull off, obviously the end goal is always to maximize that feed intake. And I think if you have the ability to do it right, a pretty rapidly, but a titrating up right at the beginning will generally maximize that if you do it correctly.
Well, let's switch to some veterinary aspects from a disease perspective. What is the influence of specific diseases such as PRRS in the herds that you're part of managing?
I think what I find interesting about, say, just using PRRS as an example, is the short answer is, I mean, everybody or probably everybody knows what PRRS is, and you know what it does. There's been lots of research that shows the financial impact of PRRS, you know, whether that's through downstream pig performance or abortions or, you know, conception rate or all of those variables. So, okay, PRRS costs money to the sow farm, without a doubt. But there are small variables to that that might vary from operation to operation. So, for example, if you are a multiplier, you sell weaned gilts, I mean, or replacement gilts, you know, having PRRS is not an option. And so the monetary value, like your business model, is to produce a naive gilt. So in that farm, most likely it's just an immediate depop, like, or else you're not going to be a multiplier anymore. It's not even not looking at like time to baseline production or time to negative, because those don't matter enough. So that's one extreme. Somewhere in the middle is a farm that sells wean pigs, maybe on the open market, and maybe their contract is set up where, as long as their PRRS is positive, there's some, you know, dock on what they're paid. And so for them, we care about time to true negative. Like, I want to see that PCR negative to be able to, you know, make the most money for my farm, or else I can't sell to my regular buyer. But then the other end of the spectrum is, what's changed a lot over the last few years is, instead of chasing time to negative, we talk more about time to baseline production, where if you don't have to have a PCR negative to be able to sell your pigs, or you're not a multiplier, then there are some strategies where we can maybe, you know, not have a PCR negative as soon as possible, but actually profit more in the long run, you know, by getting our baseline production back up faster. And we're making money because I don't care about the PCR status. As long as the pigs are healthy and they're doing well and they make it to market, then, you know, it's not. There are just those variables where some strategies, like this is maybe a bit, it's not really controversial. There's just different opinions. And that is live virus inoculation of SEP farms that break with PRRS. And I'm talking specifically like serum inoculation. And a lot of research has shown that doing that immediately will generally shorten your time to true negative. But if that's not a huge moneymaker to you to just say the word negative, and we're talking about production, then that can sometimes have a greater impact on the sow farm in the short term. Even if it takes me, say, an extra month to get true negative, but my baseline production returned a couple months sooner because I didn't do that. So just strategies like that, we just look at what will make you the most profitable over the next, say, year. And that's different for different operations.
But then generally you rather have, if of course you're unlucky to have a PRRS outbreak, to have it all happen as soon as possible rather than spread out over time?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I guess I bypass the best case is just not have PRRS, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, in those scenarios where it happens, I would say it's still, of course, our goal is to get that PRRS out of there, elimination.
Yeah, of course.
Of course. But there are different, I guess, strategies where my goal is to get it over with as fast as possible at any cost.
Yeah.
Maybe that, I don't know,
that's 60. Not a good, yeah.
Whereas the other scenarios, we're still going to get rid of it either way, but we don't care if it drags out to, say, 8 months, because I will make more money over this year than I would if I chased that 6 month timeline, for example.
Sure.
But the end goal is to still obviously clean it up.
So then, based on your experiences, are there any vaccines being used to help with combating PRRS, or perhaps not?
Yeah, again, one more discussion that's up for debate or controversy, and different countries are different. Like, this would not be a discussion we would have in a lot of the European countries, but especially in my area where it's a very pig-dense area, we do use modified live vaccines in some scenarios, and it's not that they are a silver bullet, but again, like everything else, it's a way, the pros and cons. And an oversimplified example I use is the cost of a vaccine versus if you have a farm that breaks with PRRS when they're naive versus a farm that breaks with PRRS when they're vaccinated, there will be a difference between those farms. Is there some cost associated with, say, a modified live? Yes. The cost of the product, if nothing else, no matter what you think on its impact on production. And so there will be a break point where if you're going to break with PRRS every year, which I hope it's not that bad, like that's a different discussion for you. Whereas, you know, we're a very isolated area and there's one mistake that happens every 10 years, then it's not the same scenario as to your return on. But I would say we do use a decent amount of modified lives depending on pig density and things like that. And that would be the same that would apply for flu vaccines and other things that, you know, depend on the region and the situation.
But then based on the area of pig production where you're at, generally, due to the pathogen load, there would be more vaccination, would be more routine, as opposed to other areas of the country where pig herds would be spread farther apart. Would that be a fair?
Yeah, that would be fair. I think, I mean, I'm just using PRRS as an example, but like a modified live PRRS vaccine, I would not consider part of a core automatic vaccination for any farm. And if you are a sow farm that's in, you know, the southeastern United States that might have no pigs within 100 miles, and you have a history of having no PRRS for the last 10 years, well, then I wouldn't see any reason you would need to or see the advantage. Versus a sow farm that is 3 miles from the packing plant and seems to have PRRS every 18 months, then they are in a different situation. And so you can't, one versus the other cannot say a blanket statement of do I use vaccine or not. So I would say PRRS vaccine is very situation dependent in my area of the United States.
Would there be other diseases that have popped up in farrowing in your neck of the woods? Like, is spurs the most important, or are there perhaps another one or two that you focus on?
I would say PERS is the most common as far as a disease that really changes how you approach the farrowing operation from one system to the next. You know, of course, we will see, you know, maybe Clostridiums or some mild E. coli's or things like that, but it's pretty standard to have some kind of a pre-farrow vaccine, you know, that covers your general bacterial scours. And I would say the cost effectiveness of that is most operations on the general bacterial pre-farrow scours, I would bet high 90s percentage are just doing that anyway. That those are less case by case. You know, I think of those similar to like a circovirus vaccine. Like, we're not using circovirus vaccine very rarely on case by case. It's just kind of the core. And PERS would be the one that I would say is not core. Like, your decisions on that are just entirely on your HERS status. But the other things that we deal with in farrowing, we don't have many that are one-offs. I mean, there's been some, I mean, rotavirus, not all farm vaccinate for rotavirus. And if they have that problem, we might add that vaccine. Sapovirus is kind of a newer one that, you know, is maybe out there, maybe some coccidia, but the general common causes of scours, I would say, are just kind of universally vaccinated.
But in still on the farrowing side, even when there's no routine decision for PERS, it still depends on the individual farm and where the pigs would end up, where the pigs would end up after they leave the nursery.
Maybe too broad or too blanket of a statement, but I think we have, in a very general sense, kind of two classes of clients, and unfortunately it's pretty regional, and disease pressure is how I am helping those. But you know, you have the farms that I had a new farm be built, it's probably been 3 or 4 years ago, and its location is up for debate if that was a good spot to put a sow farm. So close to a packing plant and a major highway. But either way, we actually went to that farm, you know, before the pigs were there, sat down with the owner, and we established our protocols for what we will do when we break with PERS, which might sound depressing and seem strange, but like scenarios like that, we can have profitable operations that do deal with PERS. And it's more important to me to have their expectations realistic and have a plan for what we will do when we have PERS than put all of our eggs in one basket and just bank on never, ever having PERS. And so that farm has the protocol in place. Like, they might be vaccinating even when they're healthy to try and be ahead of the next one. Whereas another farm that has a track record of being high health for 20 years, we probably have discussed what we would do if we ever saw symptoms of PERS, but you know, that proactive plan is not part of their system, just because, you know, that's not something we hope that they ever deal with. And I don't think it's foolish for them to not have all those things in place. Well, we'll deal with that when it happens.
Well, I would like to thank Dr. Gachio for the conversation. And with that, I would like to close this recording. Thank you very much.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.